The time is now 8:04 a.m. on November 14th, 2022, and I call the meeting of the Complaint Screening Committee of the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners to order. Ms. Michelson, would you please call the roll?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Meyer?
Present.
Dr. Stewart?
Present.
Mr. Wynn?
Present.
We have quorum.
Thank you. Agenda item number three, is there a motion to approve the minutes from the October 17th meeting?
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. All right, moving on to agenda number four, case discussion. The Complaint Screening Committee, pursuant to Arizona Revised Statutes 32-2081, subsection H, may dismiss the complaints appearing on this agenda or refer them to the full board for consideration and action. Complaints dismissed by the committee shall not be disclosed in response to a telephone inquiry or placed on the board's website pursuant to ARS 32-2081. Upon a vote of a majority of the quorum, the committee may go into executive session on any item on the agenda pursuant to ARS 38431.03A2 to review confidential records, or subsection A3 to receive confidential legal advice from the board's attorney, Gene Galvin. For those in attendance, please be aware that I, the chair of this meeting, reserve the right to change the order of the items on the agenda based upon parties present. Please use initials only for patients, children, and the complainant. Be aware that the content of many records involved in these complaints is confidential and the content should not be discussed in a public meeting. Be advised that the committee will go into executive session to discuss any confidential records. A person or representative of a person who has filed a complaint and is present at today's meeting may make a brief statement to the committee up to 5 minutes, only when prompted by the chair. Additionally, the licensed or respondent who is the subject of the complaint will also have an opportunity to make a brief 5-minute statement when prompted by the chair. The committee may also have questions for the complainant or respondent after their statement is made. Please note that only individuals directly involved in the complaint, which are the complainant and respondent, may address the committee and make a statement. If the committee wishes to hear from any other party, it will make this request during the case review. For everyone in attendance today, please ensure your audio remains on mute. When prompted by the committee to speak, the complainant, respondent, and their legal representative may unmute themselves at that time. Please note that individuals in attendance who speak out without committee approval will be warned twice by the chair not to interrupt. If the interruption continues after the second warning, the individual will be removed from the Zoom meeting and not permitted to re-enter the meeting. Okay. 4A, the first complainant scheduled for review today is case number 2236 for Suzanne Lachica. Am I getting that right? Okay.
Lachica.
Thank you. Mr. Wynn is the lead on this case and will provide the committee with a brief summary.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Lachica was issued her psychologist license by the board in 2014. She holds a associate substance abuse counselor license with the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners since 2009. She is employed by the San Carlos Apache Tribes Wellness Center as a clinical psychologist, where she provides individual and group counseling. DB, the complainant, was Dr. Lachica's colleague, and he previously worked for the agency as a therapist until November 2020, when he resigned. A year and a half after resigning, DB filed a complaint alleging that Dr. Lachica engaged in unprofessional behavior in the workplace by badmouthing DB and did not report unethical behavior by other professionals and leadership at the agency, to include retaliatory behavior, was not properly supervised or sought supervision from another licensed psychologist, and used odd techniques during treatment and misused her power with clients. In addition, there was an incident where DB visited Dr. Lachica's residence in December of 2021, where she used a treatment procedure on DB called IQ Detox, and he said he did not want, and beads were stuck in his ears for several days. It's probably a high-level summary there.
All right, thank you, Mr. Nguyen. Is the complainant DB present?
Yes, hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can, thank you.
Yes, hi.
If you would like to briefly add anything to that, now is your time to make a brief, no more than 5 minute statement.
And then
may have questions following your statement.
Questions for me following my statement?
We may have, yes.
Okay. Good morning, board members. I wish I was here to nominate Susan Lachica for an award. Unfortunately, this is not what this is about. First, I'd like to thank Dr. Cynthia Prater, Dr. Emock Holmes, and Jean Dilley for their service to my tribe and for their bravery coming forward. I'd like to thank Julia James and Leanne Victor, tribe members of mine from my tribe, for the service to our small rural tribal community and for their bravery for coming forward. These women have worked in their field for 10, 20, and almost 30 years. All are licensed or seeking licensure. I thank them for their bravery because this situation is as I described in the complaint. And there's reasonable fear of unethical retaliatory action by Deanna Quinn and Susan Lachica. I put in complaints to the Office of Inspector General regarding Deanna Quinn, Director, Program Manager, Clinical Director of San Carlos Wellness Center, and against her immediate supervisors at my tribe. On May 17th, I sent that. Immediately after I filed those complaints, I emailed exact copies of all the complaints to several of my former coworkers, everyone named in the complaints, the Human Resource Department at the Wellness Center. And then on May 19th, 2 days later, Deanna Quinn retaliated against me for blowing a federal whistle and what appears to be by the assistance of Susan Lachica. Susan added something to the complaint, a text, and it was informal and crude text warning her about this whole situation to come forward. I've been through a lot of trauma. It was crude, informal. But she added it to the complaint against my license in retaliation for all this coming forward. And then over the weekend, a lot of things happened at the tribe. And the following week, the Welfare and Health Committee at the tribe called or asked everyone that I named for their statements about this. And everyone wrote their statements in support of me the next week. And as far as I know, Deanna Quinn is no longer program manager at the Wellness Center. And that's basically all I have to say right now. I think that's under 5 minutes.
All right, thank you, sir. Committee members, do you have any questions for DB? Okay, I do have one question. DB, could you explain just briefly the concern you had about the intervention that Dr. Lachica provided at her house?
Yes. Well, given the timeline of all this, or everything that I described in the relationship with Susan, this is like real hard on me. I'm having trouble. Give me a second, please. Yes, I wish I was here honoring her for an award, but yes, I'm disappointed in the situation. She's known me for years, many years, and it's been tense. Everyone on the team can attest to the relationship between me and Susan,
So I'm just asking, when you visited her house, what did she do and how did that harm you?
Well, I have not wanted that active detox. They've offered, when I used to work there, she would try to get me to do active detox, and I am particular about people touching me. I'm particular about touch. I have a lot of trauma. And I just never did it. And that night, I was going through the wake of my Apache mom who passed away from COVID. She was I was emotionally distraught, repeating phrases over and over, like wiping prison walls with people's faces. And I had been drinking, and I was in no state of mind, given my history of not refusing something like that and my thing of touch. And for that situation, I believe she should have knowingly known that to touch me, having known me for those years and me denying that in that situation at that time, that was just something wrong with that. And my behavior, you know, it's dangerous, it's risky. Anything could have happened to me anywhere, by anybody.
Did you go to her house as a peer or colleague or friend or as a client?
Well, I'll explain this. I'm a tribe member of the San Carlos Apache tribe. And we have one place to receive services. That is the San Carlos Apache Wellness Center, Behavioral Health. We're a very poor tribe. I didn't have any money. I resigned because of the bullying. Many people, there's a bigger issue to talk about. And that is the only option for me with no insurance, no money, would be behavioral health services there. That's the only option.
Okay, just a second. I'm confused.
Oh, yeah.
Services as a client from the center?
Well, I consider myself a client of the Wellness Center. We've considered people from the community clients of the Wellness Center. And I feel myself as not a direct client through procedure or protocol with paperwork as a client, but as a client of the community, as the Apaches needing services. I was needing services. I don't have money. And all this was happening at my tribe and with where to receive services. I was stuck in this terrible situation. She's the only clinician left at the Wellness Center. And I mean,
DB, are other clients allowed to go to Dr. LaChica's house for services at night? I mean,
Not that I know. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I don't know her personal business too much.
Okay. So if you had to.
But I am a tribe. I am a community member. I was not really a therapist because I was never able to operate under a license. I operated as a behavioral health tech for years while I tried to get advanced degrees. My tribe, we don't have people with many people with advanced degrees or licenses from my tribe to help our people. Leanne Victor is one, and I was trying to be another, but that never happened.
Okay. Did you ever see your relationship with Dr. LaChica as she was a psychologist and you were her client?
I think that's kind of individualistic worldview. I'm Native American. We have like a more contextual worldview. And I saw myself as a member of my tribe, of my tribal community. And we receive services from St. Carlos Wellness Center. And we're all clients of that center. It's the only place we have.
Did someone coming into that center as a client fill out paperwork and informed consent stating that they are a client and receiving services?
It's a gray area. And it's gone back and forth, kind of like where that stood between different program directors or clinical directors and whatnot. Some would say they would have to at least get this and this done to be considered a client. Other times we just do have any contact we have with anybody from the community, that immediate contact becomes, they become the client to us through home visits, phone calls, when they come in, or when we have a contract with them anywhere.
Okay. Thank you. Those are all my questions. Any other committee members? Okay. Thank you, DB.
Thank you. Have a good day. Thank you.
All right. Dr. LaChica, could you and your attorney introduce yourselves?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, and those others who are listening. My name is Alexander Ritchie. I'm the Attorney General for the St. Cross Apache Tribe. And I'm appearing here representing and on behalf of both Dr. Susan LaChica and the tribe and its wellness center. And present with me to my left, I guess that could be your right, I'm not sure how it shows up on your screen, is Dr. LaChica. As far as my preliminary opening statement, I'd like to say that the complaint against Dr. LaChica should be dismissed by the board. The complaint represents baseless accusations of basically, I mean, no disrespect to DB, of a disgruntled former employee of the Wellness Center. And this was filed a year, and I'm going to emphasize it, a year and a half after the alleged incident, which precipitated his complaint. And as the attorney for Dr. LaChica in the Wellness Center, I'd like to call, if this becomes an issue, certain staff and licensed behavioral professionals employed by the center as witnesses if this matter advances to a full hearing. It is my understanding that a certain number of employees had direct personal contact with DB, and can present testimony regarding his conduct at work. Some of this is in documents that were transmitted to the board by Dr. Kim, which DB mischaracterizes as retribution. I cannot tell you at this time who exactly, because I need to further investigate the facts of this case if it proceeds. And I just want to remind the board that there's over 170 full and part-time employees consisting of licensed and non-licensed personnel. And it's my further understanding that perhaps a dozen or less may have knowledge of facts relevant to this case. We also disagree with DB's characterization of the meeting of the, it's called the Health and Welfare Committee, which is a committee drawn of members of the council. We also disagree with his characterization of the management leadership's belief about his performance and his complaint. I can tell this committee with some confidence that I will call Dr. Akin as a witness. She is she the head of the Wellness Center? No, no longer.
No, she's no. On contract.
And her, she's on contract now. And her testimony will establish that DB's conduct at work was disruptive, prevented other employees from effectively performing their duties, and that he had a substance abuse problem which adversely affected his performance at work and negatively impacted other employees in the performance of their duties. I encourage this body to examine the complaint filed by Dr. Akin with the board earlier this year. The complaint was directed against DB and set forth some of the facts of DB's disruptive conduct, which I just referred. That complaint was dismissed by the board, of course, because it lacked jurisdiction. Nevertheless, the facts in the complaint are relevant, in Dr. Akin's complaint, are relevant to the complaint filed against Dr. LaChica and could be presented in Dr. LaChica's case if this matter proceeds to a hearing. I believe that your examination of Dr. Akin's complaint would be helpful and will assist the board with its determination as to whether complaint against Dr. LaChica has any merit or simply represents the assertions of a disgruntled former employee. I'm happy to respond to any questions you may have. Thank you for consideration of my statement.
Thank you. Committee members, any questions for Dr. LaChica? Okay, the only one I have is Dr. Lee Chica. What was your characterization of the visit that DB paid you, where he complained about you administering an AccuDetox procedure?
Okay. Good morning to all, to the members of the board, and all who are present. My name is Susan LaChica. I have practiced psychology for 8 years in Arizona after receiving my license from the board. I received a master's in applied psychology from Fairfield University in Fairfield, Connecticut in 99. I received a doctorate in clinical psychology from the Arizona School of Professional Psychology at Argosy University in Phoenix in 2010. I am also licensed with the Arizona Board of Behavioral Health Examiners as a licensed associate substance abuse counselor. Since 2009. My late father was Filipino and my late mother was Puerto Rican. I am from the Bronx in New York City. In 2011, I came to St. Carlos as I heard of the Wellness Center through my doctoral training program. Mm-hmm. They have placed practicum students here in the past. In some ways, my dreams brought me to the Southwest, what some might say a spiritual connection. Typically, I see 4 to 6 patients a day, followed by group therapy sessions of 4 to 10 group members, or about 115 patient encounters per month. Annually, I have a caseload of about 20 to 30 patients. These include self-referred trauma or domestic violence survivors, substance users, tribal or federal court-ordered probationers or parolees. Currently, my youngest patient is 11 years old, and the oldest is 69 years old. This is the first complaint before any licensing board. I categorically object and disagree with DB's characterizations.
Okay, did you wish to respond to my question?
Could you please repeat the question?
Okay, how would you characterize your role and interaction with DB on the night he said he came to your house and you provided an intervention called AccuDetox?
His characterization of his visit is... It has some mistruths. He did appear unexpectedly at my door that evening in December of 2021. I was very surprised. He introduced, when I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "My mother died." And of course, I immediately, asked him to come in. He did smell a little bit like alcohol, and I served him some food, some water, and at some point after we talked a little bit and he finished his meal, I said, "I wish that I could do AccuDetox on you, but I don't have any needles. Can I put some beads in your ear? It's going to help with the anxiety." And he said, yes. He's about 6'2". And I'm 5'1". It's not like I got him in a headlock and forced beads on his ears. I put one acupressure bead in a certain point on outside of his ear. And that's it. And I did not use any invasive procedure on him. Also, acupressure beads and seeds are something you can get on Amazon.com. Lay people can buy this. You don't have to be an AccuDetox specialist. These beads and seeds come with a little card with instructions on it, and you put it on your ear for weight loss or whatever.
Could someone see your behavior as practicing psychology with your interaction with DB?
No, he didn't talk much except whatever he described in my kitchen on the walls. It wasn't therapy. He didn't divulge anything very personal except that his mother was going to be buried he didn't want to go to the funeral. And he he just couldn't. I do remember that part, but otherwise, I don't consider it therapy.
Okay. Is that a service that you provide as a psychologist at the Wellness Center? Is that part of the your intervention for clients?
Yes, that's part of my job description.
To provide acupressure.
That is part of not my job description. It's an additional certification that I acquired in 2020.
And do you offer that to clients at the Wellness Center?
Yes, I do.
In your role as a psychologist?
Yes, I do.
So it's possible that DB could have seen that as a you practicing as a psychologist in offering that service to him when you also offer that to other clients.
Well,
your job.
I need some clarification on that question because I offered it to him to help him with his emotional state. He was distraught initially. So just as my role as a human being, a compassionate human being, I'm going to offer anybody any help in whatever capacity that I'm able to provide it.
Well, except that as a licensed psychologist, we are held to a higher standard, right? I mean, if you are providing services as a psychologist, doesn't that indicate, I mean, is there the potential for DB to perceive your interaction as a psychologist-client relationship?
I think he came to me as a friend, colleague, and friend. I really never really had a client psychologist relationship with DB. We were colleagues. We have worked together. We have done presentations together. And that was the extent of our conversations at work.
Okay.
And
that was all my questions. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you. And the committee will now begin deliberation. Please note deliberation is the time for committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves and without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys. Mr. Nguyen, would you start the deliberation?
Thank you, Chair. After reviewing the case, I don't see any proof, evidence of unprofessional conduct, inadequate supervision, misuse of treatment procedures, or lack consent, or even harm to clients here. I don't see the visit to her home as a client psychologist relationship in this case. And I didn't see that as misuse or treatment or procedures. And I don't see any evidence of lack of consent either. Reviewing it, it seems the complaint, it doesn't have much merit to me or evidence to support it. I guess I'll start the conversation there.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Stewart?
Dr. Meyer, thank you. It's certainly, at worst, it seems like a sidewalk consult of one colleague to another. It seems like the complainant DB went to the psychologist's home upon the news of the death of the mother. So I'm not seeing it as a formal psychology client relationship at all.
I think for the allegations, the only one that I thought had potential was concern for me was whether there was psychological practice on Dr. Lachica's part. But I would agree there's no indication this was a client psychologist relationship. This was a somewhat inappropriate show up at a home and somebody tried to offer help. I think these boundaries are more difficult to manage when in a small community or rural community, and it requires even more work on psychologists' part to maintain those boundaries while still being a member of the community. And I think that's something to emphasize here, but I don't see any ethical violations or serious concerns here. Is there a motion?
I move that the case be dismissed.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Dr. LaChica, thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board.
All right. Mr. Nguyen.
Dr. Meyer, Chair, I respectfully have to tell you that I got to leave. I got to drive down to Tucson. So it looks like you guys have quorum, so you can continue the meeting without me. But I got to take off.
Thank you for jumping in for the time you had.
Definitely. Thank you.
Safe travels.
All right. Moving on to agenda 4B. The next complaint scheduled is case number 2308 for David McGady. Are they present? Do we have anyone? Okay. I was going to offer, I have indirect interactions with Dr. McGady in that I review his reports sometimes at Disability Determination Services. I don't see a conflict of interest here, but just wanted to make that known. But I don't see a need to recuse myself.
And before we proceed with the case review, I just want to verify with Dr. McGady's attorney, Dr. Akins, will he be present today? I don't see Dr. McGady here.
Yes, I'm a little concerned about that too. I don't see him here either. And so I just texted him to let him know it's time to check in. So if I might just offer an alternative, since I'm also counsel on the next case, and I know that that client and licensee is here and prepared to proceed, that perhaps we might skip Dr. McGady for the moment and move to the next matter. And then in the meantime, I'll also try and give him a call as well.
Is that okay with Dr. King and EL?
That's okay with me. I'm sorry, I was on mute.
Thank you. EL, is that okay with you?
It is fine with me, thank you.
Okay. Give me 1 second. Since I am the lead. Okay, so we will move to, we will table 4B and move on to 4C. This complaint is case number 2301 for Dr. Sloan King. I am the lead for this. Okay. All right. Dr. Sloan King was issued her psychology license in 2009. She's also been licensed in Minnesota and New York. She maintains a private practice in Tucson, focusing primarily on forensic services, including guardianship and conservatorship cases. The client, complainant, EL, was asked to provide another opinion in response to Dr. King's evaluation of a client, EM, who was a 31-year-old married woman who had an inheritance left to her, which was being managed by her parents. The parents had an appointment of a limited conservator of an adult. They had concerns about EM's capacity to manage the inheritance herself, and that her husband might influence her into using the funds in a manner that was not in her best interest. EM sought legal help, who hired Dr. King to determine if there was a need for limited conservatorship to oversee the inheritance money. In October of 2021, Dr. King opined that EM had the capacity to make reasonable decisions regarding her financial affairs and had no intellectual deficits. Dr. King prepared both a draft report and then a final report. The parents requested to respond to that or to exclude Dr. King's information. The court in January 2022 ruled that Dr. King's evaluation and testimony would be included, but another expert could be called in. The complainant, EL, is also a licensed psychologist in Arizona and was retained by the parents' attorney to prepare a rebuttal to the evaluation performed by Dr. King. EL opined in her report that EM was incapable of financial management on her own. EL's concerns were that there were several, in reviewing the case and Dr. King's work, there were several areas that raised concern about unprofessional conduct on the part of Dr. King, including a violation of APA Ethics Code 9.02, use of assessments, and 9.04, release of test data. Additionally, she had concerns about APA specialty guidelines for forensic psychology, including 1.01, integrity, 1.02, impartiality and fairness, 10.02, selection and use of assessment procedures, 10.06, documentation, compilation of data considered. EL alleged that Dr. King committed unprofessional conduct as follows. She misrepresented her credentials on her CV by claiming she was certified as a forensic evaluator by the Arizona Supreme Court, but no such designation exists. Number two, Dr. King performed an incomplete evaluation to address the issue of financial capacity. She did limited testing consisting of an IQ test and measure of adaptive behavior in addition to a clinical interview. There were multiple deficiencies noted on the waist. Number three, Dr. King administered the PAI but omitted it from her final report. She formed her opinion about the lack of a need for a conservator after the initial interview before completing her full evaluation. After the initial interview, she exceeded the scope of her engagement by writing to the financial manager, informing them that EM was financially competent. She did this in concert with the attorneys from EM's law firm. Dr. King did not administer any forensic assessment instruments to address financial capacity, executive function tests, academic measures of assessing computational understanding and or proficiency, executive functioning measures assessing planning and decision-making, or symptom performance validity measures. Dr. King's evaluation falls below the accepted community standard for performing evaluations of financial capacity. she did not administer any tests to determine the extent of other mental health conditions for which Ian was diagnosed or being treated at the time of the assessment. She also omitted relevant data from about Ian's capacity to support herself and social interactions. Dr. King communicated her intent to withhold this information from the PAI to Ian's attorneys. Number four, Dr. King sent a letter to the managing company, financial company. We already said that, but doing so deviates from the task she was charged with and was outside the scope of what she was retained to do. By offering an opinion, Dr. King directly interfered with an ongoing judicial process. Number five, Dr. King mistakes relevant information about cognitive assessment. She stated that the WACE 3 was an inferior major to the WACE 4. And didn't fully understand the rationale used in the DSM-5 criteria for assessment using IQ versus adaptive behavior. Number six, EL requested Dr. King's raw test data be sent to her in the community standard for exchanging data between psychologist experts. On the two occasions that data was exchanged, it was sent to EL by EM's attorneys, thus breaking the chain of custody for privileged information, compromising test security and integrity. The first set of data that was sent was incomplete and in violation of the court order to provide data to an opposing expert. This resulted in asking the court to rule on a discovery dispute to release all psychological test data. And number seven, in reviewing Dr. King's records, EL noted there was no HIPAA consent form, no informed consent, no COVID consent form, no written consent to interview her husband, and no interviews of EM's parents. And that concludes my summary. Sorry, no, it doesn't. I want to continue with the licensee's response. Dr. King submitted her response to the board in a timely manner. She noted that EL never contacted Dr. King regarding any professional concern, which is not consistent with Section 1.04 informal resolution of ethical violations of the APA Ethics Code. The terms and description used in Dr. King's CV are accurate and justified. Nonetheless, to avoid any confusion going forward, she has revised her CV to more clearly describe her qualifications. The allegation that Dr. King deliberately withheld the PAI because it allegedly contained information that was not favorable to EM is simply untrue. Before finalizing her report, Dr. King debated whether or not to include the PAI. This was based on EM's high degree of defensiveness and the test publisher's warning that validity scales indicate hypotheses may not be valid. Ultimately, Dr. King decided not to include it because she felt it offered nothing probative. There were answer inconsistencies and inaccuracies that reduced the value of the data. While it is true that she made the decision not to include the results in the final report, there certainly was no intention to conceal this action. In fact, the PAI was included in the first privilege log being prepared for submission relative to the subpoena. Dr. King's decision to disregard the PAI was reviewed in consultation with Dr. Dan Taub, JD, PhD, an ethics consultant from the trust. It was his opinion that Dr. King's defense to exclude the PAI was defensible. Dr. King also notes that she did not send a letter to the financial manager of the inheritance. She never opined on EM's need for a limited conservator, which was the key issue before the court. rather, she did offer a letter to provided to the attorneys indicating that she believed there was no necessity for EM's adoptive father to continue to have medical and financial powers of attorney, which is a different issue. She did not believe that her action had any impact on the legal case. EL alleged that Dr. King broke the chain of custody requirement when exchanging their all-test data. However, Dr. King was present both times, ensuring no one reviewed the materials, which were handed directly to an office assistant and subsequently placed the materials in an envelope and left for the post office. Even if attorneys representing either party had reviewed the raw test data, which she does not believe occurred, that would not have violated requirements which provide that raw test data may be given to third parties with consent of the client. Further, Dr. King notes that she did not violate a court order. EL was not formally engaged in this matter until February of 2022. Dr. King had been ordered to release this to a professional, and so had not released it until there was someone identified. The EL's claim that Dr. King incorrectly administered the WACE 4 is inaccurate. She provided the raw scores, but also used the publisher software and chose not to note scaled scores. Therefore, the only information missing from the raw data was the birth date, which was already known. EL complained various consent forms were lacking. Dr. King noted that she is often ordered by the court to conduct an evaluation, and she has retainer agreements which state that her relationship is with her and the law firm, not with the client. However, in keeping with APA guidelines on informed consent, Dr. King obtains oral consent from the person she is assessing when at all possible, and also utilizes a written forensic informed consent contract whenever possible. Dr. King attempts to document both consent both verbally and in writing, whether or not the individual is mandated to undergo assessment or lacks capacity to provide informed consent. In this case, EM had extensive discussions with her attorneys before giving her permission for Dr. King to be retained, which she believed was part of implied consent process. EM was also provided with a verbal explanation of the forensic informed consent contract during the initial visit to her home and was given opportunity to ask questions. She notes that Dr. King erred by forgetting to take a consent form to the home visit. Nevertheless, EM did provide her verbal permission to continue with the evaluation, though this was not documented in the record. Dr. King noted that there's conflicting opinions on whether forensic evaluations fall under HIPAA requirements, but she noted that moving forward, the most prudent course of action is to err on the side of current privacy rule and reinstitute her use of a HIPAA agreement. She noted that the husband was interviewed only after EM gave verbal permission. She's not aware of any required COVID consent forms, and she chose not to interview parents because they were adverse parties in the she did not interview the parents because she felt she had sufficient information from the records. And she is interviewed opposing parties when she felt that it was appropriate. And that concludes my summary of the case. EL, if this would be your time now, to introduce yourself just using your initials, and if you'd like to make a brief statement, up to 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I had hoped to be able to come to you from Arizona. Unfortunately, I'm in New York quarantining from COVID, and I don't have this client's records with me, so I'm at somewhat of a disadvantage. But I would like to qualify a few statements that were made and some things that were omitted. I think the most salient omission on the part of your excellent summary was the fact that when this decision was made by the Superior Court, that Dr. King was cited in that decision as having a specific response bias. And there had also been citations by the court and sanctions from the attorneys that employed her about her withholding test data. I was asked upon court order to come in and review Dr. Sloan's work after the parents discovered during the discovery process the inconsistencies between the draft report and the final report that went to the court. In looking over that data, there were email communications between Dr. King and the counsel that retained her about her decision quite actively not to fully disclose all of the information. I appreciate the fact that Dr. King felt somewhat confused about this and used the services available through the APA Trust to get a consultation with Dr. Toby, or Taub, sorry. But it is also incumbent upon forensic evaluators to present all of the data and not to selectively withhold this data and cherry pick the data that they wish to place in their reports. And it's up to other either opposing experts or the court to determine which of that data is relevant and which is not relevant. If she felt that the data wasn't relevant, she could have summarized her concerns about the relevancy of those procedures and placed those in her report, which she did not. I saw no consents at all. And the fact that in your statement, you had said that there were no consent forms from the client to release raw data. I don't believe that those things should be done orally. I think that all the all of the consents, particularly consents in forensic matters that are considered to be pretty significant in terms of financial consequences that are particular to this matter, should have required the use of written consent procedures. This was not a court-ordered evaluation. I understand that the consent processes for court-ordered evaluations are different, but to say that in Dr. King's response that there was a discussion with attorneys for implied consent, I'm not sure what that means. And I would ask for some clarification for that. I don't know what implied consent between a retaining attorney and an evaluator means, but it doesn't sound to me like it meets the criteria for informed consent when doing work for proceedings that are going to be going to the court. The other thing that I think is important is that there was some recognition by the court of Dr. King's interference with a judicial proceeding, and that needs to be recognized in terms of the representation for the complaint that I brought. The issues about misrepresentation from credentials, I think, is particularly noteworthy. To my knowledge, and I've been licensed to practice in the state since 1989, there is no certification for forensic evaluators in the state by the Arizona Supreme Court or the Superior Court from Pima County, and to maintain that on her license, on her CV, I think was a significant misrepresentation of her credentials. I think that's all I have at this time. And I might reserve the balance of my time if something else, if I may.
Dr. Morrow, you're muted.
You're on mute.
Thank you. Thank you, EL. Are there any questions from committee members? I can start. EL, did in your concerns about the ethical practice of Dr. King, did you have any thoughts about addressing her directly before filing a complaint with the board?
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. It was discussed. I did not contact Dr. King directly. There was a rebuttal report that was written, and I believe it was submitted by the court. And in that rebuttal report, the concerns that were brought forward as a complaint later were all recognized. And so she knew at that point that that there were some concerns. I also retained a consultation with Dr. David Weinstock about whether that would be sufficient or not. And we had discussed that matter. And it was my decision after my discussion with Dr. Weinstock that the rebuttal report met the criteria that you cited earlier. I'm sorry I omitted that from the discussion, but it was a consideration and it was addressed.
Okay, thank you. That was the only question I had. Dr. Stewart, anything?
Thank you, Chair. EL, what? So your conclusion in reviewing Dr. King's report, is that you were retained, you were ordered by the court to review Dr. King's work and report? Is that correct?
No, I was not ordered by the court. The parents approached the court after the discovery deadlines, I believe, had been finalized for an opportunity to bring in a rebuttal witness. And they were given 30 days to find an expert who could perform a review of Dr. King's methodology and report back to the court. So I was not retained by the court. I was retained by the co-petitioners in this matter. But it was done, but the evaluation was approved by the court and limited to a 30-day period.
And so your findings, you cite the misuse of psychometric testing equipment, testing with the WAIS-IV specifically. Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of what, where the, what you perceive to be the error?
You know, I would like to be able to do that. I don't have my file with me, and okay. I don't okay. want to make statements okay. that would be inaccurate. So I'm happy to address that in writing, but I can't address it today accurately as I sit here before this hearing.
But you did disagree with some of the findings then?
I disagreed because I think that there were certain things that were mischaracterized, and they were all my concerns were all submitted with a packet that I sent to the board for review. So they're outlined there, but I don't have a copy of that with me today. If you'd like, I'm happy to respond to that in writing.
Okay. The issue of mischaracterization of credentials. And I think you indicated that there is no such certification for forensic examiners in the state of Arizona through the Arizona Supreme Court. But you've gone through the Supreme Court training for forensic examiners yourself?
I have completed them, but there's no certification that's associated with that. The only certification, excuse me, I didn't mean to cut you off. I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's just a list that goes to each superior court district in the state. It's just a list of people who completed the training. Is that your understanding?
I don't know of any such lists if they exist, but my comment was that there, to my knowledge, isn't any formal designation of a forensic specialization that is issued by the state of Arizona. There is board certification in forensic psychology that's through the American Academy of Forensic Psychology, but that's not a credential that Dr. Sloan King holds.
Okay. Thank you. That's all I have, Chair.
All right. EL, thank you for being here and answering questions. Dr. King, if you and your attorney would like to introduce yourselves, state your full name for the record, and then this would be your opportunity to make a brief statement up to 5 minutes, and we may have questions to follow.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. I'm Farron Akins. I'm counsel for your licensee. I'll let her introduce herself. I know she has some comments. I think she's going to try and walk through many of the statements that have been alleged in the complaint and also some of the ones then brought up in the opening statement from the complaint today. I would ask that you allow a bit of leeway on the time on this for the sake of trying to be as thorough as possible, although I appreciate there may be some questions to be asked as well. So I'll let the licensee introduce herself and provide her comments.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Sloan King, and I would like to personally respond to the complaints that have come before the screening committee, and I really appreciate this opportunity. I want to assure you that I strive to be as professional as possible in my conduct, and don't hesitate to seek guidance when faced with complicated clinical dilemmas. I engage in that practice on a regular basis. In the complaints before you, a theme seems to emerge which suggests that I withheld information that was requested of me by opposing counsel and the court. This began when a subpoena was issued to me in September of 2021, requested non-privileged information related to my compensation in the case underlying the complaints, as well as, quote, facts, data, or any assumptions of the attorneys that I considered in forming my opinion, end quote. I was in process of completing my evaluation, so it was unclear what was being asked of me. I contacted a risk management consultant through the trust, and I also hired my own attorney to represent me during discussions with the attorneys who had retained me. I then provided everything I thought was being requested. And when later asked for additional information that was not originally requested, I complied. The subpoena did not request raw test data, so this wasn't included in any of my disclosures until ordered by the court. And when I was ordered to release my entire file to opposing counsel, with the exception of raw test data, I complied as well. The complainant says that I sent her incomplete raw test data, and that's misleading. When the court first ordered that raw data be released to another expert, it only specified the PAI, and another expert had not yet been retained by opposing counsel, so there wasn't anyone qualified to review or interpret the information. I again called the trust to make sure that not releasing the data was acceptable. Now, about this time, a psychologist was then retained by opposing counsel, and I did release the PAI data as ordered. But as a precaution, I waited to release the data from the remaining two tests until I was ordered to do so. The complainant apparently believes that I didn't disclose that I gave the PAI because the results were unfavorable, and that's not the case. The test results were highly questionable due to an elevation on an embedded validity scale, and I was concerned that could be misinterpreted. Once again, I consulted with the trust, and they agreed it was prudent not to include this in my opinion. Now, looking back in hindsight, I recognize that including my rationale for the exclusion of that PAI data could have, you know, better prevented the appearance of deception. But my point that I'm trying to make is that I was not trying to hide data obtained during the evaluation. The complainant also stated that I did not adequately administer the waste score and claims the record form was incomplete. I've administered hundreds of waste tests since graduate school, and I feel confident that I know what is required. But rather than walk you through the technical details outlined in the concerns, I'll refer you back to my written response, which I think explains in specifics what my process is and lays to rest the various concerns of the complainant. It was also noted in the investigation report that I didn't obtain a written consent to evaluate the evaluee or to evaluate or to interview her husband. But I did obtain her verbal consent prior to the beginning of the evaluation. She stated her understanding of the process, which had also already been explained to her by her attorneys. However, I know that I should have documented that discussion in my records, but I failed to do so. My customary practice is to review the written consent form at the start of the evaluation and enter a brief handwritten note on my interview form. To prevent this from happening again, I've created a checklist which outlines the forms I plan to review with the evaluee at the start of a meeting. I've also created a separate agreement for collateral participants, which clearly defines the role of the collateral and is specifically signed by the collateral. And the complainant also noted that a HIPAA privacy practice form was lacking. It's somewhat unfair framing of the issue, I think, because it implies my disregard for the privacy rule. The research I conducted long before the complaint and after the complaint suggests that the application of HIPAA in forensic settings is far from a settled matter. Many experts believe that forensic assessments serve a legal purpose and do not constitute healthcare services, which, by the way, is a view held by the trust. And because there seemed to be some ambiguity in this area, I took a HIPAA self-study course. I've just chosen for myself, and erring on the side of caution, I resumed use of a privacy practices notice. The complainant also alleges that before trial, I prematurely offered an opinion about a limited conservatorship issue before my report was written. I was asked for an opinion of the client's capacity to revoke powers of attorney, which is a lesser standard than a conservatorship. I believed I was preparing the letter for the retaining attorney to simply offer my opinions in writing. I thought I had sufficient information to offer an opinion on this issue only, and I had no expectation that the attorney would give the letter to his client or that she would submit it to Vanguard or the court. While I do not believe this was disruptive to the litigation, I do accept responsibility for preparing the statement and addressing it generally rather than directly to the attorney, which would have limited the distribution. And I'll certainly be mindful of this in the future. And although not part of the complaint, I do want to address a point raised in the investigative report. My New York license, it is listed on my CV. And they were correct. I did not reflect my inactive status. And just so you know, I've never actively practiced in New York, but I initially obtained the license because I thought I was going to move there, and I never did. So my CV is now updated to reflect my inactive status. On a final note, I'd like to confirm with the screening committee my understanding of the necessity of active involvement with peers in a consultation or peer discussion group. That might have been helpful in this case, but I've had difficulty finding a group in the Tucson area that is more specific to my area of practice. But I've developed specific connections with other professionals locally who I can consult when needed. That includes Dr. Joel Devoskin and a forensic psychiatrist, Dr. Bennett Blum, who often provides testimony in probate cases in which capacity is an issue. So again, thank you for allowing me to address you today and also answer any questions that you might have for me.
Thank you, Dr. King. I can start with a couple of questions. No, this is not the time, EL. This is you've had your point. One of the concerns identified by EL was that you did not directly assess financial capacity or competency. Could you speak to that on how you determined her competency without any kind of more direct evaluation of her ability to manage finances?
Well, the first thing it's more difficult with younger individuals, how to develop financial capacity. EM has average to above average intelligence and history of learning disabilities and attentional difficulties. But this doesn't mean that an individual can't, you know, manage their finances. And I did assess for financial capacity, and it's not as simple as one test. It's how the person performs, so how they can actually carry out, like paying for things and, the basics of money handling. And then there's also the judgment prong. So that's the more difficult piece to assess, because if somebody doesn't have the skills or that's something hard for them to manage money, if they have the judgment and they're willing to use accommodations, we have all kinds of technology. If you use a financial planner, in this case, there was a large inheritance. So I did assess her willingness to, she talked about plans for money, how it would be spent. I visited the home. I had a sense of what their own expenses were and how they were managing their expenses as a young couple. They had been estranged from the parents who were concerned about them for a couple of years, and they were living just fine. Maybe you can narrow me if I'm not getting at your question, but one other thing, I did a search on financial capacity assessment instruments, and there are so few, and the ones that they're all mostly for older adults, because it's much easier in some ways to evaluate financial capacity in someone whose cognition has changed. You have a baseline, but with a young person who had very little experience with money, her parents had her on a connected super savers kind of checking account, and she hadn't had the practice. So from what I could see of her skills, I believe she did have the ability and she had the rational judgment to accept help if she needed it.
Okay, thank you. Another question I have is, Dr. Stewart had alluded to this, but did you take the Arizona Judicial Branch offers continuing education for adult and juvenile competency matters. Have you taken any of those trainings?
I have. I think I missed 1 year, but I can explain that, the confusion around that. You could right now Google certified forensic evaluator, and it will, if you go to the Pima County page, it pulls up, that's the language they use in Pima County. I didn't think a thing about it until that issue was raised. I know that I don't have special certification like EL was referring to, but that's the language used in Pima. So any communication I get from the mental health coordinator at Superior Court refers to all of us as certified forensic evaluators who have completed the training. But nonetheless, I can see where that would be confusing. And even though it's the language used here, I have changed my CV to say that I completed the training, so as not to imply that it's certain kind of certification.
Okay, thank you. The final question I have is about the allegation of response bias and the writing the letter for the attorneys prior to having completed your written evaluation, but also the leaving out of the PAI in your final write-up. So could you just directly address response bias and how this looks for I guess the easiest word to say is kind of cherry picking data in a non-objective manner.
Well, when I first I had debated this because, as you heard, it showed up in a draft report, a small paragraph, but I said, but there's extreme caution. This is not necessarily a valid profile because she was trying to present herself in a favorable light. So it really may tell you nothing. So then when the attorneys that retained me were asking questions about the profile, that's when I thought this is what I worried about. It's raising more, questions when you try to interpret it when it's not likely even valid. I even had a chance, but you can't say why it's not valid necessarily. It's not, you don't know if it's effortful manipulation on her part or just that she has no insight into her limitations. So because of that, and the caution was,
but can I just stop right there though? Yeah. But wouldn't that information be important to know in this evaluation?
And as I said in my prepared statement, I would be fully transparent again, the next time. I guess I was fearful about how it might be misinterpreted, but that can't, I recognize that what I would do over is say that I gave the assessment, but that it didn't weigh into my opinion.
I guess that's what I found most surprising about this case is I've just assumed when I read an evaluation that the psychologist is listing all of the evaluations they completed, not just the ones that they wanted to write up. And you typically see concerns about validity addressed in the write-up. So I guess this seemed like non-standard practice. Have there been other times when you don't include test data that you had conducted?
Not that I can remember.
And so why this time?
Well, I think it was a pretty contentious proceeding and it was pretty emotionally charged. I was concerned that it unfairly portrayed this young adult. She had a lot of information, just personal information that was revealed that I didn't think was really even important to the issue at hand. And I was worried about, the violation might be somewhat dramatic, but the fact that this could be somewhat misinterpreted. In fact, EL had the data, and her interpretation was that it was intentional manipulation on the part of the client, and that can't be interpreted from that scale. Yet I take responsibility for the mistake I made in excluding it, because I don't typically do that.
Okay, thank you. Those were all my questions. Dr. Seward, any questions?
Thank you, Chair. Dr. King, thank you for being here today. So this evaluation, you were ordered by the Superior Court of Arizona for Pima County to conduct this evaluation?
No. No, I was retained privately.
By a private attorney?
Yes.
And that private attorney was the attorney already representing EM?
Yes.
In your interpretation of the testing data on the waste floor, I believe I heard Dr. Meyer indicate in the opening comments describing your response that you used the proprietary software assessment report data from the company, from Pearson on the waste floor. Is that correct?
Yes.
And there's a selection process in that as to what is printed out in a printed form. So do you normally print out the scale scores in addition to any index scores or IQ scores?
I print it all out for myself, but because my audience is usually the court, I don't include that. What you're talking about, that printout, what I do is I take the index scores, and I feel like that's more user-friendly for the courts because it gives a qualitative description, like average, you know, below average. Now, when I do a disability evaluation, they do like to, I haven't done one for a while, but they do like to see the scaled scores. And so I include that portion of it.
To follow up on that question, if I may. So on that printout that you did for yourself, did you send a copy of that to the complainant, to EL?
No, I just sent her the raw scores and made a copy of the record form.
And just sent her a copy of the record form?
Yes.
At the end. Okay. do you see a problem in that, of not sending her the entire printout?
I didn't think so, because I thought with the waste, that's one of the tools that you can score yourself, or you can use the scoring software.
So the court order that you received, the subpoena for records, rather, was sent to you by the opposing legal counsel, and you received that prior to completion of your final report for the court?
Yes, but I think you said this correctly, but the court did not send the subpoena. It was opposing counsel.
Opposing counsel, okay. And that was, now your understanding of release of records, in a forensic case, you had an attorney at that point in time?
Yes.
Okay. And your attorney at that time was Dr. Akins?
No.
Okay.
It was someone locally.
Okay. And did that attorney, did you understand that even without a written consent that you could send sensitive client material to the opposing attorney simply because of that relationship of the, you had received a legal subpoena and were responding to that? And so even without the written consent, the opposing side would have a right to that information?
They weren't asking for that. I do recognize that I could have asked for the client's release, or, you know, permission to release the information. The subpoena was narrow. They weren't requesting raw data. In fact, they respected that. I did not want to release the raw data all of the process until there was an expert. So all they were asking for in that early subpoena was what I relied on in my decision so far before I submitted my, you know, before the report was done. So they merely wanted to know what I was being paid and what conversations, if any, or information from the attorneys that I relied on in my opinion at that point.
Excellent. Thank you. Did you receive any additional financial compensation by writing a favorable report for EM versus one that would be unfavorable?
I haven't even been paid. And another a lesson that I've learned, Dr. Aikens is a great teacher. And in cases like this, when somebody can't access the funds, I've not been paid. But I recognize that it has somewhat of the appearance of like a contingency, you know, and going forward, I am not going to accept a case if I feel like if we can't work that out exactly what I'll be paid from the beginning, so people won't think that I provided a certain opinion because of what I was being paid.
Thank you. That's all of my questions right now, Dr. Meyer.
Okay, thank you. The committee will now begin their deliberation. Please note that deliberation is at the time for committee members to deliberate the case amongst themselves without interruptions from complainants, licensees, or attorneys representing licensees. I can begin the deliberation. To be honest, I guess there are a couple of concerns I see. But I was also a bit surprised to see this submitted as a complaint to the board. I guess if I can just go through kind of the main allegations, I'll come back to leaving out the PAI, but listing the fake certification on the CV, I mean, it's a... As Dr. King said, if you Google certification with Arizona, it comes up with a very clear description of the trainings that are there. It talks about court-approved evaluators. I didn't see any issue with this. I guess, Dr. King, you could change it from certified to court-approved because that's the actual language on the website. But I found that a little silly. That financial capacity and competency was not directly assessed. Again, if you've got someone that's almost 30 years old that's testing in the average range, you don't necessarily need to do... I mean, we had previous reports saying that there were no evidence of TBI. There was no indication there to say I've got to really narrow in on executive functioning in this case. I don't think. I think that looking at judgment and performance and current functioning is sufficient. The letter that was forwarded on to Vanguard. All of the testing was done. She had already done all of the testing episodes and the interview. She hadn't written the evaluation yet. But so I don't see how there was a concern of writing the letter before the complete report was done, and submitted. I do think making it vague on who it was to puts you at risk, Dr. King, that I think if you're going to do a separate letter like that besides an evaluation report, it should be for a very specific reason. But again, ethically, I don't see an issue here. And again, transferring the test material through lawyers, I didn't see any issue with. This was a forensic case to begin with. This was, the consent was signed with the attorneys, not with the client. That was very clear. And in a legal case, there's no reason to not be able to do that through attorney exchange. I thought that was, I don't see a concern there. So that leaves some of the forms, and I think that not having a written informed consent is a concern, even if it's, if the evaluation is set up with the attorney, and to say that you did it verbally, it wasn't documented anywhere I could find, which means it didn't happen, right? That the lack of informed consent, and then the leaving out of the PAI. I think that I understand the rationale, but I don't think it's a good rationale to leave that out. Because it does suggest a bias, and Dr. King alluded to what I would suggest was a bias in saying she was worried about how it would be interpreted, that there was concern about how other records had been used. Now, I agree with all of that. I think I would have come up to the exact same conclusions as Dr. King did. But it looked like you were trying to protect the client as opposed to doing an objective evaluation. Those are my thoughts. Dr. Stewart, I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer. In forensic cases, it's certainly different. And just for, to remind myself, the lists are sent to each jurisdiction of the people who've completed the Supreme Court training. And so the folks who do Rule 11s and 26.5s and post-conviction relief, those lists of approved psychologists and psychiatrists are sent to each jurisdiction. The cherry picking of the data, I think it gives more of an appearance of bias than a real bias. And I think that's, my stumbling block there. I don't know that there was any real bias as much as there was an appearance. And again, I highly recommend that, if you're not receiving extra financial reward for, sloping your opinion one way or the other, the clearer you are on that, the better off you are. Informed consent, I think, Dr. Myers covered it. The attorneys were involved and they're the ones that provided access to the client for the evaluation. Use the standard software published by the test publisher Pearson. So I'm not really seeing any, did you release the subscale scores or at the time? No, but if this is a 30 something year old with average range intellectual capacities, I have to agree with Dr. Meyer that you don't have to do, there's no specificity involved other than you know, would she buy a red Corvette or a blue Corvette? And how, you know, what she does with that money, if he has normal intelligence, if it's her inheritance and that needs to be honored. Again, your report is not the court order. Your report is not the final decision of the court. You're just an advisor. You were retained by the EM's attorneys. You rendered a report. Opposition retained a psychologist. She rendered her report. And then it's not your decision or the opponent's psychologist's decision. It's the court's decision as to what will be done. And you're just providing information to the court. The cherry picking of the data, leaving out the PAI, again, it gives the appearance of bias more than anything else, in my opinion. But I'm not, Dr. Meyer, I'm not seeing any real substantive concerns myself.
Yeah, nor do I. So I'd make a motion that the case be dismissed.
I'd second that.
All right, we have a motion and a second. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None. The motion carries. Thank you all for being here and your responses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. And everybody doing okay? Keep going. Okay.
So let's go ahead.
Go back to 4B. Case number 2308 for David McGrady, Dr. David McGrady. I said this earlier, but just wanted to say it again with you here, Dr. McGrady. I've had indirect interactions with you reviewing your records at Disability Determination Services. I don't see a conflict of interest. If you have any concerns, I'm happy to recuse.
I don't have any concerns.
Okay. Nor do I. All right. So, Dr. Stewart, would you provide the committee with a brief overview of the complaint?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Meyer. This is a complaint from RT. And on this specific complaint, 2308, the complaint is that, and I'll try to be as succinct as possible, but the complaint itself is rambling. And so I'll try to, if I'm missing something, please let me know, slap me around a little bit. But on this complaint, it's that Dr. McGrady did a forensic evaluation for the court on competency to stand trial on RT, and that the complainant says that Dr. McGrady came up to a wrong diagnosis or a diagnosis that was in conflict with what the complainant says is a long-standing diagnostic impression from the VA where he received services. That he said there's a whole rambling diatribe there, and we come back to that Dr. McGrady did not include a fair and honest history for the complainant. And also that Dr. McGrady did not provide the complainant, and this would be at the time the defendant in that court case, a copy of the evaluation. So Ms. Michelson and Ms. Packanon, did I forget anything in the complainant?
No, Ms. Dr. Okay. Sirleaf summarized it very well.
Thank you. And so now I have Dr. McGrady's response. It was timely. And he responded point by point to all the concerns raised by RT. And that Dr. Brighetti is a vendor for the psychological health services that does the evaluations in Maricopa County Superior Court. And he's performed over 1,000 Rule 11s. The purpose of the evaluation was to help determine whether or not the evaluee understands the proceedings and is able to assist their legal counsel in presenting a defense for a criminal charge. Dr. Brighetti did determine that the evaluee was not competent to proceed. And Dr. Brighetti indicated that the court controls what information is available to the evaluator. So the complaint that Dr. Brighetti left out pertinent VA health records, and Dr. Brighetti says that he's not in charge of the VA and can't go into their electronic medical records and secure such, and that he's reliant upon the court and the attorneys to provide him with information. Dr. Brighetti completed the evaluation in February of 2021. That evaluation, the report was sealed. Now, as I do recall that the prior, in looking through the court's order, the judge's order, that the previous mental health records were unsealed and provided to Dr. Brighetti. So he had access to Dr. Frizzell's previous Rule 11s and the other competency evaluation. In doing a standard practice of doing forensic evaluations for Rule 11, 26.5, et cetera, is that the examiner, the psychologist or psychiatrist, provides a copy of the report to the court. And then it is at the court's order and behest that any copies are sent out. Normally, that in my experience has been that the court will send a copy to defense counsel to be reviewed and redacted, and then back to the court, and the court sends the redacted copy to the prosecution. Dr. Brighetti says, as an evaluator, it's not his records. The court owns that material, and that he's not permitted to send out copies of reports to interested parties. Dr. Brighetti, going back to his report to the court, describes the behavior of RT. And this gets to the diagnosis, misdiagnosis, ancillary diagnosis, and describes quite well and in depth the disruptive behaviors of RT during the evaluation, and that at one point in time, the interview had to be terminated because of the defendant's behaviors. Dr. Brighetti erred on the side of caution in saying that this man was not mentally competent with those kinds of behaviors that he was looking at. Several pages of response to the allegations, because having trouble, I'm sure, determining what to respond to. Dr. Brighetti says that in his report that he never diagnosed RT alleged that the VA diagnosed
diagnoses.
I'm sorry. Sorry. With a different diagnosis, and that would be something that Dr. McGiddy would be unaware of. Ultimately, the individual had yet another mental health evaluation, and the court ultimately ruled that the RT was competent to proceed. Dr. McGiddy outlines that it was RT himself that created some of the prolongation of the hearing process by asking for continuances. Dr. McGiddy states that RT's communication to governmental authorities was so frequent that the court ordered his access restricted. Some of RT's threats and complaints were made against persons before those persons had taken any action or even involving an RT. And that's basically the summary. If I've left anything out, please let me know.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Stewart.
Thank you.
And I don't see RT here.
I do not, Mr. Chairman. I actually did email him back on November 4th and inquired if he would be participating. He did respond to my email, but did not address that at all. So we can go ahead and hear from Dr. McGiddy and his attorney.
All right. Thank you. And so Dr. McGiddy, if you and Dr. Aikens could introduce yourself and provide a brief statement.
Thank you, Dr. Myers. This is Farron Aikens. I'm counsel for your licensee, Dr. McGiddy. I'll let him introduce himself, and I know he has a few words to provide for you this morning.
I'm Dr. McGiddy, the licensee. I just wanted to thank the committee for giving me some time to address the complaint this morning. First, I think it's really important that we clarify the roles in the matter before us today. In this matter, the court was the client. The complainant was certainly the evaluee. And while these roles are certainly synonymous in most cases, in the matter before us, they are not. I was appointed as a mental health expert to conduct the complainant's Rule 11 evaluation by the Maricopa County Superior Court. The Rule 11 evaluation is not comprehensive, nor is it diagnostic in nature. Its purpose is to determine whether the evaluee understands the proceedings from both a rational and a factual standpoint, as well as are they able to consult and assist with their attorney with the preparation of their defense pursuant to the Daubert standard. As the court was the client and as the appointed mental health expert, the court determines which records I am able to review and to whom the report can be released. The court clearly ordered the complainant's Rule 11 report sealed upon completion of his Rule 11 hearing on June 4th, 2022. This is consistent with the Arizona Rules of Criminal Procedure, as well as the administrative order establishing the contract for mental health experts in the state of Arizona. As such, this report cannot be released without written order of the court. The release of the report to the complainant violates at minimum two standing state statutes, as well as two standing orders from the judge overseeing the complainant's criminal case. HIPAA also indicates that information compiled in reasonable anticipation of or use of in criminal, civil, or administrative proceedings is a recognized exception to individual access. As such, the refusal of to release the Rule 11 report to the complainant does not violate his HIPAA rights. The complainant's VA medical records were not reviewed in preparing the Rule 11 report, primarily because they weren't provided to me. The complainant did request that this psychologist acquire those records. However, acquiring records lies outside the responsibility of the court-appointed mental health expert and clearly lie with the defendant, the defense attorney, and the county attorney, as clearly delineated in the notice of appointment. The complainant was informed of this limitation during the evaluation. In my evaluation, the complainant was not diagnosed with a characterological deficit or personality disorder. Characterological deficits were mentioned as they were documented in prior records provided for review, and they're mentioned to provide the trier of fact with as complete a picture of the complainant's functioning as possible, given his limited participation in the evaluation. The complainant alleged that he was diagnosed with conditions that are typically considered trauma-based and difficulties with mood swings. Whether this is accurate or not, I'm not sure. I have not reviewed any records that indicate it as such. However, the complainant's presentation, in my opinion, was most consistent with other diagnoses and predominant factors that were the foundation for my opinion that he was not competent to proceed. I appreciate that I'm not permitted to discuss diagnoses in an open forum. However, if the committee wishes to discuss my rationale for the diagnoses, I'm more than happy to do so in an executive session. I also appreciate that the complainant has expressed concern regarding the fact that I had not reviewed the records that he believed were pertinent to his case. However, I would like the committee to understand that these records were not provided to me and that I am not able to legally access those records of my own accord. My experience with these type of evaluations is that access to records are limited to the mental health expert as dictated by the court. And it was my intention to follow the dictates of the court regarding my responsibilities as a mental health expert. If the committee has any additional questions, I'll do my best to answer them.
Thank you, Dr. McGady. I appreciated the inclusion in your response of the relevant regulations so that I didn't have to go look them up. I don't have any questions. Dr. Stewart?
Sure. Thank you, Chair. Dr. McGady, thank you for being here today. And I'm sorry you have to be here today. So it's your opinion that you were prevented legally, statutorily, from providing the complainant with a copy of the mental health report evaluation that you completed for the court. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. That's all my questions.
All right. Dr. McGady, thank you for being here and your responses. Committee will now begin deliberation. Dr. Stewart, would you like to begin?
Thank you, Gottmeyer. Having done many of these evaluations myself, the standard policy is to complete a report and send it to the court. It's up to the court as to what to do with that evaluation. The court has possession of that. And so it would be inappropriate to release it to prosecution or to defense. And that's the court's domain altogether. The records, Dr. McGady could not possibly have obtained VA records on his own. And normally the court provides records or the attorneys involved supply records. I don't see any issue there. In terms of the offending diagnosis, I looked through Dr. McGady's report and there is no such diagnosis that Dr. McGady made. The offending diagnosis was a part of a report from another examiner, Dr. Virzel, and that was described in someone else's report, and Dr. McGady simply cited that in his report. So I'm not seeing anything of substance for this complaint.
I agree. I didn't see any ethical or legal violations or concerns. You have a motion?
I move that we dismiss the case.
Seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? None. Motion carries. Thank you, Dr. McGady and Dr. Akins.
Thank you, Dr. McGady.
Thank you.
Thank you, committee members.
All right. And moving on. We are ready for agenda item 5. Is there a... Wait, before I say that, thank you for all the help, staff.
Oh, yeah.
And dumping this on me. Appreciate it.
Anytime. You're welcome. Okay.
Is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. The meeting is adjourned at 9:58 a.m.